Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the fastest growing segment of our society. To those who know that the world's political, religious, media, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, all of them, that they are actually counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the headlines, to know who is working against our interest, to understand why they are doing so. Because exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes isn't hateful. It's compassionate. It's appropriate. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, which means teaching, not law, because its covenant provides the only reliable answer for you and your family. And there's only one covenant, not two. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, is 877-300-7645. I'd like to begin at a place we left off almost a week ago. We were talking about the impending presence of the Roman Catholic Church before the United Nations. And actually, they didn't come in as the Roman Catholic Church. They came in as the Holy See, which is the name that they use, and that's S-E-E rather than S-E-A, the name they use for their country, the Vatican. So they wanted to be a big-time operator, and so they signed the Rights of the Child International Treaty as a nation, as the Vatican, which they call the Holy See. And they were then taken to task by the United Nations for having been the world's largest abuser of children through the pedophile priest scandal worldwide, and also the deliberate cover-up where they allowed priests to continue to abuse children rather than to hold them accountable or to turn them over to the judicial authorities and the countries that they were operating in around the world. Well, the United Nations conducted its inquiry of the Roman Catholic Church, and even though they gave them, I should say, the Vatican, let's treat them as a nation as they wish to be treated, and after giving the Vatican 6 months notice on which documents needed to be produced and which questions needed to be answered, the Vatican essentially produced no documents, and they were unable to answer or unwilling to answer any questions. So at the end of all of this, the United Nations, and this took place last week, reported their conclusions against the Roman Catholic Church. I have a number of stories regarding these conclusions. Let's go through them. The first reads, the United Nations demanded that the Vatican immediately remove all clergy who are known or suspected child abusers and turn them over to civil authorities in an unprecedented and scathing report, which was released Wednesday of last week. What that says is that the United Nations, which is the first to do a international investigation of the Roman Catholic Church, came to the conclusion that they are still harboring child abusers, that they're still covering up their crimes, that this is not something that, as the Roman Catholic Church wants to have the world believe, that, oh, this took place 10 years ago and 15 years ago and 20 years ago and, of course, 50 years ago and 100 years ago and 200 years ago and all through their history, but that they're better now, so you can just leave them alone and don't look at all of the crimes that they perpetrated against children, nor their cover-up, because they're better now. The United Nations came to the conclusion, no, they're not better now. Now, before we continue on this story, we have Norman, who has called in from the fine state of Georgia, who has a question or a comment, as I understand it, on the book that is called John. It's actually written by an individual whose real name was Yohanan. Hello, Norman.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine.
My question is John 8:44, and that's where Yahshua is speaking to, what it says in 8:31, the Jews, And in 844, he said that they were of their father, the devil.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Revelation 2:9.
Oh, let's talk about one thing at a time here.
Well, it's the same subject.
Okay. All right. Go ahead then.
They are speaking of the Jews that are not Jews. And I just wanted to know what your insight was on.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you have to be really careful on the terms that you read in an English Bible. For example, in the Torah prophets and Psalms, there's no such thing as a Jew. There's no J in the Hebrew language. There most certainly couldn't be a Jew. And so there couldn't be a J. And the W, in Hebrew is pronounced as an O, not as an E. So there just is no possibility whatsoever for a Jew, from Yahweh's point of view. From God's point of view, there are, Yisrael, represents, either A, the land, or the collective whole of the descendants of Jacob, who he renamed Yisrael. Yisrael means individuals who engage and endure with God. Or it can represent just the northern kingdom, apart from Yehuda. Yehuda is the region and people who the name means related to Yah and to relate to Yah around Jerusalem. So Yisrael can mean any of those things. It can mean the entire unified country. It can mean all 12 tribes. It can mean the northern kingdom, which would be the tribes distinct of Yehuda and usually also of Benjamin. And Yehuda itself just applies to one particular tribe. So since we have this translated from the spoken language, which was Hebrew, into Greek, we've lost that distinction. So at this point now, it becomes almost impossible to know, in fact, it probably becomes impossible to know who specifically Yahusha was addressing, because while there are very specific terms in Hebrew, they don't exist in Greek, and then we've bastardized them and twisted them into English. Now, almost every time that we find Yahusha speaking, he's speaking to one of three audiences. One is just an absolute general audience, not described. His largest and his longest presentation that is recorded is what we call the Sermon on the Mount. It wasn't a sermon. It was instruction on the Mount. And that audience is undisclosed in terms of who was in the audience. Then we have him say a lot to those who are either his disciples or who approached him recognizing who he represented and were desirous of knowing more, of learning more. And he spoke to them about the process of how you could come to learn more. And his teaching with them and his statements with them were identical to his statements to the larger group, which was, if you want to know me, look to the Torah and prophets and you'll understand who I am. You'll understand who I represent. You'll understand even what I'm doing, that I'm Torah observant and I'm here to fulfill the Mikra. Now, the third audience, and it's the audience that is addressed here, is those who came to confront Yahusha, who were opposed to him, who wanted either to trip him up or to diminish his credibility or to try to rid themselves of the nuisance of this man who was so opposed to religion and politics. And so with them, you know, he's going to make statements like this to say, you know, you don't represent what the word Yisrael or Yahudim means. I mean, these folks did not relate to Yah. They were not related to Yah anymore. You know, in Hosea, Yahweh says, I've divorced you. And even with Yisrael, Yahweh in the book of Hosea, Hosea specifically says, I've divorced myself of you. You are no longer my children because of, you know, your propensity to flirt with and to have relationships with false gods. So both of that kind of scenario would help you understand why he's talking to people who were once the heirs to the covenant, who will once again be the heirs to the covenant, but at the time he was speaking to them, they were divorced. Does that help?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I ran into your program accidentally, and I'm just, talk about shattering myths. You've shattered me. Thank you.
Well, you don't need to go right, just make a bigger statement, because in the totality of what you're talking about here, my assumption is that you either were or are a Christian, but for the first time ever beginning to recognize that there's some real problems with Christianity, and that God is knowable, that he wants us to know him, and that he never discarded his Torah and prophets, and that's the way to know them. Am I correct in assuming that you're somewhere on that spectrum?
I was raised Roman Catholic, and from there went to about every religion out there, and nothing was correct.
Yeah, all religions are just paste on a pile of lies. The one that you were born into may be the worst in terms of universal deceit. You know, I always look at Islam, and I may be, you know, in the top half a dozen people in the world in terms of understanding Islam. I've written a number of books on Islam, and you look at Islam, and it's just, it's religion for idiots. It is so obvious the religion isn't true that, you know, you just really have to be a nincompoop to be a Muslim. You're not thinking to be a Muslim. It's impossible that the religion is true. But then you look at Christianity. What Christianity essentially did is that it melded together every pagan tradition from Babylon to Rome, and then it placed all of these pagan traditions right on top of the truth. And so there's little glimmers here and there of that which is true that give their lies credibility. And so, to recognize that Roman Catholicism is a pile of lies, as well as they sell it and market it, takes some considerable doing. So I admire your ability to do that. If you can stay with us, Norman, past the break. We also have Mike calling in from Texas. I'd love to continue this conversation and then bring Mike in as well. I think Mike wants to talk about the Syrian war, so it's an unrelated subject, but let's finish this with you, Norman, and then we'll move on to Mike. Stay with us. We'll be back after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Norman on the line, first-time caller from Georgia, that has come to realize that you're not going to find God or truth in religion, and that it is that all of them are wrong in the sense of filled with conflicts. The passage that you you referenced, Norman, really fits right along with this journey that you've been on, where Yosha was condemning. I mean, every time that he spoke to anybody in their religious or political establishment, he exposed them and condemned them. Just as every time Yahweh references them in the Torah and the prophets, he does exactly the same. And so it sounds like to me that you wanted your understanding of God to be in sync with God's own presentation. And the only way you can do that is to question and then walk away from religion.
I've walked away from a lot of them.
That's great. One of the things that I would encourage you to do, and maybe you're already in the process of doing, is that there are a number of really excellent tools that you can use. If you have completely distanced yourself from Christianity, then there's no reason at this point to read Questioning Paul. But if there is another listener that hasn't yet come to the place where they recognize that Christianity is false, Questioning Paul is a really good place to start. If you have been religious and now are questioning your religion, there is the best place to go, I think, is introtogod.org, introtogod.org, because what it does is it presents the oldest source material that we have available, presents the nature of the Hebrew alphabet so that you understand it, the grammar of Hebrew, the resource tools, the research tools that we have to be able to understand what God said, and it gives you the full toolbox and say, all right, here's the full toolbox, and now rather than just give you the toolbox and say, you know, have fun with it, we go through the seven topics that are most interesting, most important to Yahweh, and say we're going to use these same tools that I've just given you to go through what God had to say so that, you know, your actually in the using these tools. And so an introtogod.org is the best place to go. And I always tell atheists and agnostics, those who are socialist, secular, humanists, who don't know that God exists and don't think that God is knowable, that they should really turn to Yada Yah first. And YadaYah.com is the name of that that series of books, because it proves that God exists, and it proves that he authored his Torah and prophets, and it teaches along the way. But its primary purpose is to demonstrate that God is absolutely knowable. So it sounds like you're on the right journey, my friend.
Yeah, it just seems like if we get rid of the what's called the New Testament, we're better off.
Yeah, in fact, we'd be better off if we were to discard all of it, with exception of Yahusha's statements. And then even with Yahusha's statements, we have to be really careful that we correlate what he said with his testimony in the Torah and prophets in Hebrew, which is easy to do for the most part, because most of what he says is either a quotation of them or a summary of them or an affirmation of what's said in the Torah and prophets. And so I think his statements are highly usable from that point of view. And you mentioned Revelation. Revelation is also usable because it's mostly Yahweh through Yahusha revealing to Yahuchanan what the future is going to be like. That too is useful. But the rest of it, yeah, it's far better off tossed away. You know, another thing.
The synagogue of Satan.
You know, the presentation that Yahweh makes of the kind of the future history of the world, and while I'm saying this, Mike, we're probably going to run out of time here in this segment. I really do want to get to your statements and concerns or issues regarding Syria. So if you could please hang on through the next segment, we'll turn to you at that moment. Yahusha is talking about in the beginning of Revelation is kind of the history of the world from the time that he has now fulfilled the first four Mikra up until the time that he returns, which will be his seventh visit here in corporeal form. And he gives you kind of a history in major eras. Through that period of time, he talks specifically about the birth of a religious movement that is twisted out of his what he has done. And it's, you know, he calls what has become the Roman Catholic Church first. You know, he says that they're the seat of Satan. And then he refers to them as being married to the Lord, which is Baal, Satan. And then he says that they're dead. And in the midst of that, he refers to he can't use synagogue because the word didn't exist in Hebrew at the time, but a congregation that's associated with Satan, which can be more than just Christianity. It could also incorporate Judaism, which, you know, Judaism isn't any better than Christianity or Islam. They're all false. They all lead away from Yahweh. They're all inspired by the adversary. Anyway, Norman, thank you for the call. We'll be with Mike when we return. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We've had Mike having called in from Texas that's been most patient. Where in Texas are you from, Mike?
Dallas area.
Okay. I'm in and out of Texas a lot, just why I ask probably four or five times a year. I like the Dallas-Fort Worth area, but most of my visits are down south of you along I-35 and what I affectionately call Waco.
Right.
I understand you have a question or comment on the Syrian war.
Yeah. So I hear a lot in the news about Homs and Aleppo and Syria,
mm-hmm.
you know, fighting and all that.
Yeah.
So Saturday afternoon I was reading Jeremiah chapter 49.
Well, the fact that you know what the name actually means, that's a good sign. When you actually, you know, I don't get to talk to a whole lot of people that actually know that it's Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyah means Yahweh uplifts. It speaks of God's desire to get down on his knees so that he can lift his children up. It's the reference to the Father's role in a family, and thus our Heavenly Father's role in the covenant. And Yirmiyahu, which has been corrupted to Jeremiah, is a really, really interesting book, I think, for two reasons. just sharing kind of my take on the book as a whole. One, it's the only book that I'm aware of that is specifically addressed to Gentiles, to Goyim, and not to Yehudim. It opens by saying, I'm writing this on behalf of the Gentiles. And the second thing that is interesting, it's a treatise from beginning to end on what God doesn't like about religion, politics, militarism, and economic schemes.
Right. So let me read here.
Sure. Uh-huh.
Okay, so Yirmiyahu 49:23
okay.
through 26.
Okay.
Concerning Damascus, Hamath and Arpad have been put to shame, for they have heard an evil report. They have been melted in anxiety like the sea, unable to rest. Damascus has become feeble. She has turned to flee, and trembling has seized her. Distress and pain have taken hold of her like a woman in labor. How has the city of praise deserted the city of my joy? Therefore, young men fall in her streets, and all the men of battle are cut off in that day, declares Yahweh of hosts. So the first city is called Hamath, and that's Strong's H2574, which means fortress.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so from Wikipedia, Hama,
mm-hmm.
a city on the banks of the Orontes River in the west central Syria. It is located 213 kilometers, 132 miles north of Damascus,
mm-hmm.
and 46 kilometers, 29 miles north of Homs.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about that is it's like where the kind of where the Syrian war started. The city was once again the site of conflict between the Syrian military and opposition forces. It was one of the main arenas of the Syrian civil war in 2011 and 2012.
Yeah, it's been devastated.
So...
And it's just been absolutely devastating, that whole region. But, yeah, that's where it started, and it has been turned to rubble. And the pictures out of the areas which where the Sunni rebels first seized, those areas, and it hardly looks like there was even a city there. It's just giant piles of rubble.
So I guess my question is, do you think that Jeremiah 49:23, is that speaking about current events, or is that speaking about things that happened like 2,600 years ago? When,
you know, there's only one time where it appears that Damascus, in particular, is to become no more, and that time is still on our future horizon. It's the longest continuously inhabited city in the world. And so Damascus has not been destroyed yet. It is in the process of being destroyed, but it's not destroyed yet. You know, this, and I'm what I'm going to do for you, and I'll do it here in the next few days, is I will I have not translated the entirety of Yirmiyahu, so I will deal with that because I'm in the midst of translating. Yashayah, which is Isaiah 17 and 18, something I haven't done for the last 10 years. That was the first, turned out to be the very first Hebrew passages I tried to translate 10 to 12 years ago. And it also begins in Damascus. And it ties in with this and says, Damascus is no more. It's turned into a pile of rubble. And it goes from Damascus being besieged and turned into rubble, and then systematically through... The consequence of that, which is that Israel is thinned at the waist, narrowing her midsection where 70% of the people live so that the country is no longer sustainable. And then from that, what we see is this multitude of Muslims that come into Israel as a direct result of the nation becoming more vulnerable because of what the United States is doing, trying to impose the sacrifice of land, particularly the West Bank, after having sacrificed Gaza, to the Muslims. And immediately thereafter, according to Yashayah in 17, chapter 17, we then see hordes of Muslims that come in as floodwaters and also roaring in from the seas. And the carnage and devastation, according to Yahweh, is immense. And Israel, he says, is so vulnerable at this time that it cannot defend itself, and he has to intervene, and he drives them away. And then that transitions as you come out of that to a direct attack on a country that there are some 14 attributes that are given by Yahweh, the first five of which are unequivocal. America. And it says, you've been warned, America. This is what's going to happen to you as a result of what you've done. So that also ties in, begins at Damascus. So I will, over the next few days, I promise I will review what you've just cited from Yirmiyahu, 40th chapter, did you say?
49th
chapter. And yeah. I will combine that in a report because as part of current events, I want to present Yirmiyahu 17 and 18 is part of our current events presentation in the first 2 hours of Shattering Myths, and plan to do that sometime over the next a couple of weeks. So I will share with you everything I learned. But I think your primary question is, do I think that what is being discussed here is a future prophecy that we're seeing fulfilled before our very eyes right now, or speaking of something that occurred in the past? And I think the answer is absolutely something that that we're seeing in the future. Yeshayah's presentation of the fall of Damascus, it being turned into rubble, and out of that, Israel being thinned at the waist, and then just an uncountable number of Muslims roaring and flooding into Israel, destroying everything in their path, is a yet future event.
Okay. All right, thanks, Yara.
Yeah, the only thing I have not been able to figure out, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to figure it out from this, I'd hope to be able to figure it out, because I get a lot of questions from folks saying, well, then how do you think the what's called a civil war in Syria is going to play out? Because the war in Syria is not a civil war. This is not a war between Syrians fighting Syrians. You know, the Syrian war is a proxy war. It was started because the United States invaded Iraq, gave Iraq to Iran, gave Iran, therefore, complete control over Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. And that scared the, you know, cloaks off of and turbans off of the Saudi, Kuwaiti, and Qatari Sunnis, along with the Turkish Sunni Muslims, because they were no longer the most powerful force in the region. And so they started a proxy war that is a war to pit Sunni against Shia. And what I don't know, and I have yet to find a place that reveals this, do the Sunnis ultimately prevail against the Shia? Is this just a throttling mechanism to keep them from attacking Israel en masse right now so that we make it through these next 12 years or so before the Magog War begins? You know, do Sunnis prevail and therefore it's an all-Islamic attack unified? Or do they finally decide that there is one thing that they despise more than one another, and that's Israel, and they, after the destruction of Damascus, they turn their attention to Israel, and in that one battle they're willing to fight side by side after having killed each other? I don't know how it's all going to play out.
So al-Assad is a Shiite?
No, al-Assad is really a secularist. His family, his clan, is from the Alawite variation of Shia Islam. When Saddam Hussein was in power in Iraq, Assad and Saddam were best buds. They both came out of what's called the Ba'ath Party, which is essentially a fascist and secular, non-religious party. And they had an affinity for one another, and they were allies of one another, while Saddam Hussein and Assad were in charge. And both were opposed to fundamentalist Islam, because they knew that fundamentalist Islam brought terrorism with it. But when the United States saw to it that Saddam Hussein would be deposed and killed. Then Assad formed his allegiance with Iran. He doesn't have oil, so he is dependent on an OPEC nation in the region. And he came under the dominion of Iran, and largely also because of the influence of Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is Shia, and most of the rulers in Syria, even though they are also secularists, as is Assad, they're secularists out of clans that are Alawite or Shia, and therefore there is, even though it's a secular government that the Sunni fundamentalist rebels are opposing, they're able to couch it in Sunni-Shia terms, so that they can call it the Great Jihad to rid the world of the infidel form of Islam. Well, Mike, thank you. Great calls, great insights, those are my thoughts, and I'll be glad to invest the time over the next few days and over the next 2 weeks. I hope to devote a number of shows to the current events that were witnessed 2,700 years ago. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. If you'd like to participate in this conversation, it's toll-free, 877-300-7645. Returning to the story of the Vatican and the United Nations, the opening comment from the United Nations tells you what you need to know, that the United Nations has recognized that the Vatican is still up to their nostrils in allowing pedophiles to go undetected, and that they're still in the process of covering up the scandal, which continues to make children vulnerable. Now, if you are a Roman Catholic, what in the world is wrong with you? And if you are, as a Roman Catholic, sending your children, particularly your sons, to a Roman Catholic school or to church for some purpose, unattended, there's something dreadfully wrong with your ability to be a parent and protect your children. The UN watchdog for children rights denounced the Holy See. That's another term for the Vatican and the government that is established by the Pope and his cardinals for adopting policies which allow priests to sexually abuse thousands of children. So the UN says, you know, the problem with the Vatican, the Roman Catholic Church, is they have adopted policies which allow priests to sexually abuse children by the thousands. It's not that, you know, this just happens and it's a large organization, so you'd expect some bad behavior. No. The UN, having conducted the first worldwide investigation of the Roman Catholic Church, says, no, it's your policies that are responsible for the sexual abuse, for the pedophilic attacks on thousands of children. It's not something incidental to Roman Catholicism. The UN Committee on the Rights of the Child said church officials had imposed a code of silence on clerics to prevent them from reporting attacks to police and move abusers from parish to parish in an attempt to cover up such crimes. You know, there is a crime worse than pedophilia, and that is covering up the crime of pedophilia and allowing the pedophile to continue to abuse children. I did a number of shows, probably a week's worth of shows, twice now since we've been doing Shattering Myths, on this specific issue. And what I found is the internal document has been released, not because they chose to, but because it's impossible in today's world to keep secrets this important. But the internal document that was written by Cardinal Ratzinger, who for more than a decade was in charge of the Roman Catholic Church's authority on both doctrine and discipline. And as head of that, he came up with a policy that is the one that Roman Catholicism adopted. because he was in charge of dealing with this problem, this blight on Roman Catholicism, for the 10 to 15 years when it was initially being manifest around the world, first in the Boston Diocese trial where Roman Catholicism was found guilty of molesting hundreds of children and convicted, then all the way through to Los Angeles, which finally caused his resignation as Pope. And during that time, of course, the most massive case was discovered in Ireland, but every country of the world now has an investigation, any country that has a significant number of Roman Catholics. Every region of the world might be the more accurate statement, from Europe to South America to Central America to throughout Europe, the Mediterranean, even into Russia. Roman Catholicism is on trial, and in every case they've lost. There isn't a single case that I'm aware of that they have prevailed. And so Ratzinger, who became Pope and then resigned immediately after the Roman Catholic Church lost the case in Los Angeles, where Ratzinger and the church itself were implicated in the cover-up, wrote a document that says, in essence, that while a pedophilia is a moral crime, the greatest crime that can be perpetrated by a Roman Catholic is to make the Roman Catholic Church vulnerable by failing to keep the acts of pedophiles secret. And that they were threatened with excommunication and all sorts of slander if they didn't keep it secret, if they didn't participate in the cover-up.